Morning, family. My name's Mark Houston, and I'm an alcoholic. On the morning of October the 19th of 1982, power of God showed up in me and separated me from alcohol, and it is that power that has kept me separated from alcohol since then. And I'm grateful for that. I don't know if you saw, but the back of Eric's head, he looks like one of the little rascals. He's got this piece coming up. I just figured that was a result of some meditation he did this morning, you know. Another interesting observation, and I understand this. See what I mean? If spiritual living was easy, there'd be the same number of people in here this morning that were at the dance last night. I applaud those of you that are here. And I understand that. I understand putting myself in a dance ahead of God. I did that most of my life. But at some point in time, you continue to live life, and if you live long enough, and if you don't drink and die, you're going to get taken to the place where nothing but God and knowing God becomes the bane of your existence. And that's exactly what happened to me. I try not to take myself too seriously anymore, but you asked me to be your spiritual speaker this morning, and I take that pretty seriously. And the end result of that is I'm going to talk to you primarily about steps 2, 3, 6, 7, and 10, 11. Any more before I'm asked to talk? Oh, one thing, a couple things. My home group is the Clean Air Group in Dallas, Texas, which is where God has got me living right now. And as I mentioned, my sobriety date is October the 19th of 1982. We do that in Texas, and one of the things that I've learned along the years is to adhere to the group conscious of wherever I'm at. When I first moved to Texas from Colorado, I thought that was somewhat arrogant on their part. And then, of course, good sponsorship will draw you up short and said you might want to look at why you don't want to give your sobriety date. Once again, you're going to be different, right? They're not doing it your way, see? That kind of a deal. If you want to know what it was like for me, there's a lot of tapes out there you can find. Buy them. I'm not going to spend any time with you this morning about that. I will tell you that when I came to you all in 1982, that I had brain damage, kidney damage, liver damage. Everything I owned was in a duffel bag. There wasn't anybody on the planet wanted much to do with me, and I could not quit drinking alcohol. And that's what it was like. Lots of fun. You know, when you're new, if you're fairly new at the program, you like to hear speakers that talk a lot about what it was like because that's the only experience that you have. You know, and you relate a lot. And you can always tell it. Conventions, listening to speakers, you can always tell length of sobriety, because a lot of times, if you're fairly new, once the guy's done talking or the gal's done talking about what it was like, you get up and leave, because you have no frame of reference for what recovery is. What is this thing that we do in here? What is it that we do in here? This whole thing for me has become about the power of God manifesting in my life. Big Book says in the ninth step that we're here to be a service to God and to our fellow human beings, and unbeknownst to me, when I came to you all in 82, that this program was really going to be about the death of self, but I did not know that. One of the things I also like to do is I like to let people know currently where am I at with spiritual living, if you will. There's a trap I fell into, and if you get a little time away from a drink, you'll fall into it too. And the trap is that you're going to begin to rest on your laurels and talk about when you came in here and all the stuff that you used to do. That almost killed me at 10 years in this program. I almost committed suicide, wound up in a psychiatric hospital for a period of time. Upon careful reflection, that had a lot to do with a lot of things. Had a lot to do with a lot of unwritten inventory and unfinished amends and very little work with the strict disciplines of the 10th and 11th step. So if you're kind of doing that, where you're just your program is centered around going to a lot of meetings but not much step work, very little with 10, 11, and 12, you too can have that experience. I got to tell you something about me and this relationship with alcohol. Never once in all the years in which I drank and did dope did I ever occur to me to commit suicide, and it has many times since I've been sober. Now, you know, if you're like me, that ought to catch your attention. What was that about? Well, my experience is there's only two things in my life that have ever made me feel comfortable in my skin with you. One is a lot of whiskey, and the other is a lot of God. So if you come into this program and you have this idea that your problem is alcohol and just not drinking is your solution, you, like me, are probably going to experience a lot of times in sobriety where you say to yourself, you know, if this is what this is all about, I don't want to have much to do with this. I did not set out in my first 10 years to get taken to where I got to. In hindsight, you know, the big book, there's two deaths that I've had to die in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you the first one. My big book says that I must be convinced to my innermost self that I'm a real alcoholic. And there's about 60 pages in the big book in which I will go into my experience and I will look at that to become convinced of that. But there's another death that you got to be willing to die if you're going to hang around this program. And that is that I must be convinced that any life based on self-will, sober, cannot and will not ever work. That's the second death that I went through in 1991 at 10 years. We have a methodology for bringing about the death of self, if you will. That's called the steps. And in particular, it's called steps 4 through 9 with a firm foundation in the first three steps. They asked Thomas Merton, who was a mystic monk, one time about God, and I think he summed it up best. He said, when it comes to God, silence makes more sense than words. And the reason is you do not experience God with your mind. You experience God with a part of you that already knows God. Most of what my mind has ever told me about God has had absolutely nothing to do with God. The same mind that brought you to Alcoholics Anonymous is not the mind that you're going to use to come to know God. That makes sense? Yeah. The organ that brought you here is not the organ you go to for a solution. Tell you currently where I am. I live in the spiritual dimension of the 10th, 11th, and 12th step, and I resubmit to the first 9 steps once a year. Tuesday, I sat down with a pal of mine from New Jersey, and we swapped 5th steps. We started at 9:30 in the morning. We finished at 6:30 at night. Now, I'm sober over 18 and a half years. He's been sober almost 20 years, and we spent almost nine hours looking at a resentment, fear, and a sex inventory. You got to ask yourself a question. Well, see, I want to go to God in a 6th step, in white robes and a little halo. I went to God in the 6th step with horse manure all over my face, and I wasn't quite so much. Why is that? How does that happen? How does all this stuff come up? This judgmentalism and these resentments and this selfishness and self-centeredness, dishonesty and this fear. I love God as much as any person that I've ever met. I do as much with the strict disciplines of 10, 11 as anybody that I know in AA, and that's the truth. And I got all this stuff that shows up. 9-hour inventory between the two of us. That was equally divided, by the way. I just thought I'd throw that out there. Particularly if Dave gets this tape, you know, I don't want you all thinking most of that was about me. See? I'll tell you how that comes about. Your ego is as mysterious and powerful as God himself as far as you're concerned. You cannot defeat your ego. It'll take the best of you. No longer you're sober, the ego still operates in the same fashion, but it's got new faces. What do I mean by that? The new faces are things like sponsor, spiritual man, spiritual woman, you know, leading member of the group. It's just new faces. The longer I'm sober, the easier my life, but the harder the work. See, when you come into AA, it's pretty easy. You're looking at yourself and you're seeing a thief and a liar and a cheat and all those other things that you see. But then you get some time and you begin to live with spiritual principles, and the ego just takes on new mask and new faces. But the same self-seeking dishonesty, resentments, and fear begin to manifest through those no faces. That's why the work becomes more difficult, but that's also why I continually go through the work. Out of that particular inventory now, I have completed my list, and I have 9 people that I have to go to in 3 institutions. I stay as current as anyone I know at 10 and 11, but I fall asleep for periods of time. Most of you are like me. You're going through life asleep, dreaming you're awake. there's a trap you fall into around this God issue and the power of God in your life. Here's what it is. God keeps me sober. Well, there can be no God if there's nothing but God, so is God a part of staying sober? Of course. But if God was the only solution for people like you and I, the big book would be one page, and here's what it would say. God keeps you sober. Have a good day. That isn't what it says. There's 174 pages, and 30 of them have a lot of very precise instructions about writing inventories and doing fifth steps and some work in six and seven, and then making a list of all these people, and then going out to these people and cleaning all that stuff up, and then begin to work with the disciplines of the 10th and 11th step. And that is all designed to do what? To keep me in fit spiritual condition so that I don't take a drink today and that I can live my life by spiritual principles. So I'm going to make some of you a little uncomfortable. So let's go look at the last week, and I want you to ask yourself the same question I have to ask myself. My book says that upon awakening, I'm supposed to be doing some prayer and meditation. So the question would be is go into the last week and ask yourself this question. How many times in the last 7 days did I get up and do my morning prayer and meditation, not just prayer? My pal Paul summed it up best. If all you're in this program and all you're doing is praying, imagine yourself in a relationship with a significant other and all you ever did was talk and never listen. I doubt if that'll work too well. That's what meditation is. So if you haven't done that in the last 7 days, are you at risk in terms of not being in fit spiritual condition? My experience is absolutely. So that's one piece. The 10th, 11th step gives you all kinds of tools to work with during the course of the day as you go through the day. What are those? Watch, ask, turn, cease fighting anything or anybody. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. The line of the will, the use of your sixth sense, conscious contact. Pause when agitated or doubtful. Freedom from self-will. And then my book says, Mark, upon retiring, you need to do a review of your day. You need to answer a whole bunch of questions about the course of your day. During the course of your day, Mark, were you resentful? Were you selfish? Were you dishonest? Were you afraid? Do you owe an apology, Mark? Were you kind and loving toward all, Mark? Or were you thinking of yourself most of the day? And then it says, then you ask God's forgiveness and write out what corrective action to take so that you can take action on the next day so you can stay clean, to face and be rid of that which has you blocked from the power you need to not drink. Those are the things I have to do every day, 24/7, 365 days a year till the day I die, if, in fact, I want to stay sober and if, in fact, I want to maintain conscious contact with God. I've had many times in Alcoholics Anonymous where I was not doing the things that I just discussed with you, and I paid a dear price for that, a very dear price. When I was sitting in that insane asylum at 10 years sober, and you can't dull that pain that I was in because there is no alcohol anymore, because if God don't want you drinking, you're not drinking. That's my experience. I had people say to me, why don't you go drink? This was prior to going in the nut house. I said, I can't. See? There's this idea that once God removes the drinking, the obsession from you, somehow you have the power to get in the car and go down to a liquor store and buy alcohol. That is not my experience. God removed that from me. God removed choice around alcohol from me. See, I'm not a kind of drunk that gets up in the morning and chooses not to drink because I lost the power of choice. I attract chronic relapsers. I assume it's because I'm doing penance for some bad stuff I've done. I say that because they're very difficult to work with. They have a tremendous amount of answers, can't hit the rear end with both hands. Their four favorite words are I know and yes, but. They know the book better than you and have a lot of answers. Of course, you know, 2 days sober, 3 days sober, 5 days, you know, that kind of a piece. But the one thing that I always ask them is, latest example was a woman who's been around AA for 20 years, one time in 7 years, picked up a drink, and she'd been drinking 3 years, and back in the rooms now, has about 5, 6, 7 days, and I asked her if she was involved with her last relapse. She said, oh, absolutely. I said, well, where did you get the idea that you sober, you have the power of choice around drink? She said, what are you talking about? Pages 23 to 43 of the big book, I believe, are the most misunderstood pages in the whole book, and it is those pages that turn me into a seeker of God. It is those pages that convince me from now to the day I die, I must continue to embrace spiritual living and continue to grow in conscious contact with that which has created me. Because it's in those pages that I come face to face with the most insane thing I'll ever do, I do from a state of consciousness called sobriety. And that is that my mind will convince me to take a drink again, and there's nothing I can do about that. I cannot prevent my relapse. Till you have that experience, you will not do what this program asks you to do. The extent to which you're sitting here this morning thinking you are somehow involved in staying sober is the extent to which you do not need God. Those pages are incredible. I just looked at those pages about 2.5 months ago, where I'm reminded in squiggly lines that I've lost the power of choice in drink. Sober. I had a sponsor that tricked me one time. He said, write down the 10 most insane things you ever did. So I did what all of you would do. I wrote down all the neat stuff I did once I had taken a drink. And he looked at me and he said, Mark, the most insane thing you have ever done is not on this list. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I mean that if this is what you do when you take a drink, then the most insane thing you'll ever do is sober. Your mind will tell you to take a drink and you'll act on that. And I got it. I got it. God bless these continual relapsers. They've never had a clue. They really think they're involved in staying sober. See? This program is not a program in which I get and keep myself sober. This is a program in which I pursue a course of action to experience a power, and the power does for me what I've never been able to do for myself, and to not forget that. And in those incredible pages, it takes you into many different states from a position of sobriety in which you drink. Talks about the idea of no effective mental defense. And effective mental defense, ladies and gentlemen, is one that works every time. So if you had an experience like mine, which is that it did not work every time, then you, like me, are going to need power, because those pages get summed up at the bottom of page 43, and it says, once more, mark at certain times as no effective mental defense against the first drink. Here's the horrible deal, the roll of the dice. I don't know what the time looks like. See, some of you may have the luxury of not working with the strict disciplines of 10 and 11 because you think you know what the day looks like when your mind's going to take you back to a drink. I don't. Those pages talk about a guy named Fred. I love Fred. You know why? The day he drank, there wasn't a cloud in the horizon. We all know what that looks like, don't we? We got a job, got a car, got the little girl, little guy hanging on the arm. Got some money in her pocket, got a little time sober, and we think to ourselves, boy, ain't life grand. Fred drank on that day. See, my deal is one day at a time, pursue a course of action which allows me to stay in fit spiritual condition, and that is completely my responsibility. It's not God's. My first 10 years in AA, I threw it all on God. Did very little work with the steps in hindsight. But that's an easier, softer way, isn't it? You follow? See, along the way, some things begin to change about this idea of God, and here's the first. I don't know about you, but I think most of us have some idea about God prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. My experiences over the years, God didn't change. God didn't change because I got sober. Well, what happens? Well, that power shows up and separates you from alcohol, and then that loving God seems to put us in a program and gives us a big book, which gives us very precise, specific, clear-cut directions to experience the death of self. You know, the big book is so tricky. You come into the program, you start working out of the big book, and the first 33 pages are talking about you and drinking. See, this is how smart we are. 33 pages are designed to answer one question. Do you lose control when you drink? But they got to come at us every way in the world, right? Well, sometimes, I was a binge drinker, and I 33 pages to answer one question. Yeah, I lost control. And then, unbeknownst to me, my first time through the steps, is the book didn't talk to you and I about drinking anymore from page 23 on. You know why? Because alcohol is not the problem. But I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I think alcohol is the problem. Why is this point significant? Because if you're in this room and you think alcohol is your problem, then not drinking would be your solution, wouldn't it? But if you're in this room and you understand alcohol is your solution, then you're going to pursue a whole different course of action, aren't you? So that takes me, you know, up to this third step, and it's only in the third step that I'm finally told what's wrong with me. This is always about this. You know, it talks about selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. That when I am centered on myself, I go through life driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. The end result of that is I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. You see that in inventory, don't you? Column 1 and column 2. And they hurt me, column 3. But at some point in time, I made decisions based on self, because after all, it's always about me, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. Therefore, all my troubles are my own making. You don't think they really meant that, do you? I mean, aren't there some of you in here this morning that surely some of your troubles got to be of someone else's making? And it goes on to tell me where these troubles come from. They arise from within myself, and then the book says something. This is what I want you to start talking about in your meetings more. It says, above everything, I must get rid of this selfishness or it will kill me. Any alcoholic I've ever known who relapsed behind their selfishness. What's the connection between selfishness and picking up a drink? Here's the connection. When you're centered on yourself, when you haven't done much work with 4 through 9, and you will be centered on yourself and there's nothing you can do, then the world and all of your arrangements will not stay fit. That people won't do what you want. Mom and dad and ADD, you know how it looks, right? And when that happens, you and I become diseased, restless, irritable, discontent. Bedevilments show up in our life. And at some point in time, I know what I'm going to do to treat that condition I got going on inside me. And my mind is going to convince me at some point in time that what will treat that is a drink of alcohol, and I'm going to take a drink and activate a phenomenon called craving. So see, the whole problem lies in my selfishness. That is the problem. And if I don't get rid of it, it's going to kill me. And you're up against this. I don't care how long you're sober. I don't care if you're sober 50 years. I got some long-term sobriety in my sponsorship lineage. One man, 55 years. He wrote inventory 3 times last year. See? He understands what's wrong with him. He understands that his ego is mysterious and powerful as God himself as far as he's concerned. Thank God I had some men and women like that. Thank God I had men and women who would continually work and rework the steps, particularly the first 9, and operate in the spiritual dimension of 10, 11, and 12. As far as I know, there's only one method. And then the next sentence in the book, by the way, around the selfishness that's going to kill us, our name is not in that next sentence. Isn't that terrible? It says, God makes that possible. Right? So the very thing that produces all the misery and leads me back to a drink that lies within me, I can do nothing about in my power. That's why you make your third step decision. It's just a decision. Here's what's always funny. In the third step, you make a decision to turn your will and life over to God, right? Think about this. All you're doing is making a decision to turn your will and life over to that which created your will and life. We act like it's some big deal, right? And the way that you implement that decision, the way you begin to die the death of self, prior to that decision, the book says, with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. So the way that we do that is we write the inventory steps 4 through 9. I do a lot of work with steps 4 through 9, having the foundation of the first 3 steps in place. And the way that you look at how your selfishness shows up in your life is you write those 3 inventories. Resentment inventory, fear inventory, and a sex inventory. And that's all it is. You're going to operate how your selfishness operates in the universe. The only time I've ever had a resentment is, it's very simple. Someone didn't do what I thought they needed to do to somehow do something that would make me feel better. Of course, the horrible dilemma and all that, over the years I've found out that I cannot have no say-so over your behavior. As much as I'd like to, see? So I write those inventories. Fear is always about self-reliance. I'll give you a little exercise to test your current agnosticism. People with time always hate this question. Because the ego likes to believe that after you've been around for a period of time, or believers hate this question. The extent to which you experience fear in your life on a daily basis is the extent to which you have current agnosticism. You understand what I just said? You leave here today and tonight, go home and make a list of what you're afraid of currently. I don't mean old stuff. Job, relationship, blah, 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 physical health. I don't care. Make a list of what your fears are. I'm talking current stuff. I'm afraid to talk to people. I'm afraid to go into meetings. I'm afraid they won't call on me. Afraid they will, blah, blah, you know, whatever it looks like. Those fears are the areas in which God does not exist in your life. It's your current agnosticism. See, the second step asks that you make a decision that God is everything in your life. My whole goal in my life today is to be present to this moment, the only place in which I have conscious contact, yet I have a mind that's never present. My mind is either in the past or in the future, never present. So the only place in which I get to experience conscious contact, I'm not there. Now here's what this leads to, and you can all relate to this. It leads to a sense of separation. Complete sense of separation. You walk into a room like this or walk into a meeting and you feel completely isolated and separate from. That loneliness the big book talks about. It's like a screen comes down and you're not a part of. The ego's sole function is to keep you in a state of separation. Hence, the main problem centers in the mind. That separation, it has to do with separation from conscious contact with God, from your true self, and from your fellow brothers and sisters. That's its sole function. I got a couple young pals in here, early 20s. When they first met me, their ego was giving them all kinds of reason why they didn't have to listen to a guy like me. See, he's got silver hair, for God's sakes. The hell, what does he know? See? Now, I got to tell you about God. My hair was dark brown till the third step decision. See, unbeknownst to me, the process of the steps, everything that you all want to use as to why you're different from me, gets totally stripped and you begin to experience oneness. You know, it'll use your ego will use race and it'll use gender. It'll use money, you name it, it'll use it to keep you separated from. Today, as a result of spiritual living, I'm against anything that speaks to me of separation because there's only oneness. Anything that speaks to any of us about separation is not based in truth and is not based in God. Anything, including your religion. There's only oneness. Spiritual living is about finally understanding that. See, when you finally understand that, if you're awake, aware, mindful, and conscious, you could no more harm your fellow brother and sister than you could stop breathing and live because you understand your fellow and brother and sister are you. That simple thing I just talked about, can you imagine what would happen if we would not only grab that in Alcoholics Anonymous, but around the world? That is the thing that will kill us within Alcoholics Anonymous. Kills groups. Our group's different. Our group's better. We're younger. They're older. They're long time sober. You follow? See how it looks? They're men. They're women. You know. They're Caucasian. They're, you know. Sponsored a couple African American men, and they asked me a question. You know, it's funny about your prejudice. This is the love of God. Every prejudice I ever had, God allowed me to sponsor. So if you're prejudiced, I promise you, you'll have the same experience. See, you start to realize one day that I am not my skin and I am not my gender, you see. You start to understand that. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, God loved us so much, he puts us into a fellowship that everything my ego wants to use to separate me from you, our traditions will not allow you to embrace that. Isn't that amazing? So back through those steps, you write the inventory and you do a fifth step. Then you go to God in six, And you have a list of all these character defects that is your selfishness, your ego is using to operate in the universe, that keep you blocked from God, from your true self, and from your fellow brothers and sisters. And I want to tell you something, everyone in this room, you're no different from me. I have yet to wake up in my life and say, I think I'm going to run with these character defects today. That's not how it works. But when you're going through life, asleep, dreaming you're awake, powerless over alcohol, consumed with yourself, you become like a tornado. And all the sixth step is identifying the toolkit of self-will. Selfishness, dishonesty, manipulation, justification, whatever. My personal experience is different than some people in AA. They will talk about working on their character defects. That's a scary deal to a guy like me. What does that mean? I'm going to say this again for those of you who want to work on your defects. The mind that creates them is not the place you go into to get rid of them. You know, I identify those in the sixth step, and I humbly, on my knees, ask God to remove those because of the pain that they create in my life, because they always lead to separation from God, my true self, and from you. And I can't live that way anymore. Hell, I can't even do my mistake, what I used to do on purpose. See? It's too painful. And that's what my seventh step is, and then I begin and I make my list, and I go out and I begin to make amends. If you have a lot of unfinished amends, you're going to continue to be separated from your fellow brother and sister. That's my experience. So another exercise I might give you to do when you leave here is ask God to show you unfinished amends. Make the list and go make them. See, my wholeness, my oneness with you began to manifest itself as I plowed through these amends. The mother and the father and the brothers and women and past employers and the money, and to clean it all up. Most spiritual disciplines I have ever studied embrace this. The carpenter said it best. He said, before you come to my altar, if you got something going on with a brother, I want you to go with that brother and clean it up and then come to my altar. You know what that's about? See, if there's nothing but God and I'm blocked from God because I have one resentment, then I need to go clean that up. To the extent to which you have resentments and unfinished amends is the extent to which you are blocked from God. Because God is in every person. So if you have one person, you cannot go to. If you have one person, they're stuck between. You are blocked from God to that degree. Go make your amends. Go finish your amends. To begin to practice and work with the strict disciplines of the 10th and 11th step, be able to sit in meditation. I love the silence today. To begin to love the gaps between words. To begin to love solitude. Silence is the language of the spirit. We're in a culture of words, 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 words. Talk, 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 talk. Amazing. I'm in an interesting place in my spiritual life because everything else evolves from that. But if I was never asked to speak again, that would be a wonderful thing. And I suppose it's because of being in that position that I get asked to speak. See, when I wanted to speak, I never got asked. When I don't want to, that's how God works, right? He takes men and women like us, and I can assure you, if you want it, the best thing that could ever happen to you is you not get it. So I'll give you all a little hint for those of you obsessed with relationships is if you can't live without her, then you can't live with her. And when you can live without her, then you can live with her. So get to that place. A couple more minutes here, and I'm a lot more interested in hearing this choir than I am myself. Meditation. I didn't do anything with meditation my first 10 years. Meditation changed my life. If you said to me, of all the things that you've done since God got you sober, what's the single most important practice you've ever done? I would tell you meditation. My current practice is I sit 2 times a day. It was a meditation that I came to know God. It was a meditation that I came to be able to experience deep conscious contact with God. It was via meditation that I came to love my true self, know my true self, and begin to love you at a level that I never could have done before. I can't imagine a day without meditation anymore. The sixth sense, the big book talks about in the 10th step, defines what the sixth sense is. It's called conscious contact. As I stand in front of you right now, I'm experiencing the presence of God within and without. That's all I ever wanted. That's why I drank. See? Now we get to do this sober, this thing, this incredible thing. If you're not meditating, I would ask you to consider doing that. I will make one statement about that. If you haven't done much work with the first 9 steps, it's going to be impossible to meditate because you're going to want to sit in the silence and you're going to have the chatter of 1,000 monkeys going on. It's hard to do. So begin to consider working with meditation. I could spend 5 hours on the 10-step alone. In meetings, we use the short form. But there are so many spiritual practices contained within the 10-step in the big book. There's some powerful stuff in there I would encourage you to start talking about in your meetings. Like, here's one. You know, you go to a meeting and they ask for a topic. Next time they do that, here's what the topic is. Share your experience with what it's like to have entered the world of the Spirit, the 10-step promise. Yeah, it will be a short meeting. See, I would ask that you would leave here and begin to take some different things back in your meeting, you know, and this is about new people. Imagine a new person walk into the room, and what we're going to talk about is our personal experience with the power of God, not a belief in God. We're going to share the incredible things that God has done in our life. We're going to talk about having conscious contact with God. We're going to talk about having entered the world of the Spirit. We're going to talk about the line of the will on a daily basis in which your will is aligned with God's will. We're going to talk about great spiritual practices like watch and ask and turn and pause. And we're going to talk about what it's like now to be an agent of and for God and what it's like to be of service to God and to our fellow human beings. And we're going to be able to share what it's like to go through the death of the self and the subsequent peace that comes from all of that. Imagine then if you were a new person. See? Imagine then. Imagine how excited you might get based on how you'd been living your life. Our meetings ought to be pep rallies for people who need hope. I want to close with a prayer. That's one of my favorite prayers. Thomas Merton wrote it. It's called A Prayer of Surrender. And it's one of my favorite prayers because it so just describes me and my experience. It says, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean I'm actually doing so. But I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I'm doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, that you will lead me through the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may have seemed to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my peril alone." God bless you. I love you.